Scenes from September 11th used in TV campaign ads. Is this a shameful exploitation or a tasteful portrayal of a leadership challenge? Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke. This is Rewind on KUOW 94.9. A leisurely look back at the news of the week. And we'll talk about those the president's first TV spots in a moment. We'll also open the phones in the next hour and ask you for your reaction to these ads. You can view the ads now at www.georgewbush.com/TV ads. Be aware, though, your computer may have a George Bush firewall on it, which would prevent you from visiting a conservative site, in which case you can go to Google and find your favorite viewing option. Other news stories to talk about this hour. Martha Stewart might go to jail. We'll hear from a woman who once served time at a so-called white-collar prison and says it is no club fed. People who want King County Executive Ron Sims to offer same-sex marriage licenses are going to march on the county administration building next week. Sims has said, I can't do it. It's an explicit violation of state law. It's not the same as in Oregon. But should Sims defy state law and civilly disobey? Also, is it any of your business what Major League Baseball players choose to sprinkle on their Wheaties? And will there ever be liberal ditto heads on AM Talk Radio? Those questions coming up this hour. Let's meet my guests. Filmmaker Sandy Siafi is producing a documentary on the Immigrant Workers Freedom Ride for PBS. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, Bill.
And Knute Berger is the editor of Seattle Weekly. Welcome.
Hey, Bill.
So before we talk about Bush's first TV campaign ads, let's talk about who his opponent in the campaign will be. That was the big news this week. The Democrats closed ranks. John Edwards graciously dropped out of the race after John Kerry dominated Super Tuesday voting. And the big question moved from, can Kerry win the nomination, to, can Kerry win the presidency? Skeptics say Kerry has trouble connecting with people, but on NPR's Day to Day, reporter Scott Horsley told us that the man's campaign personality is evolving. Horsley took us to a campaign rally in Atlanta where Kerry got a rock star welcome from some young women.
Well, I love you too, so we got a great thing going on here. And you have an ability to hit a high note I've never heard. I love it.
It was a rare moment of public spontaneity for a candidate whose sometimes mechanical style prompted Dan Rather to ask this past weekend whether Kerry has enough Elvis in him to compete with President Bush.
Okay, Dan, I'll ask my guests. Does Kerry have enough Elvis in him to compete with President Bush?
Well, that hoarse reply that he gave, he sounded a little like Clinton, didn't he?
He did.
Yeah, I love you too up there. Hey.
Could that have been intentional?
Come on down. He does seem like a fairly stiff character. But I remember with Bill Clinton also early on in his campaigning, he did not come across well on television. His speeches were very long. He looked kind of too slick. You know, there was a lot about Clinton that people didn't like. But when you saw him in person, there was a whole different energy, a whole different kind of charisma.
Yeah, but how many people see a presidential candidate in
person? Well, not that many, but it's an opportunity. You know, the word of mouth gets out there. Mm. You know, people say, hey, this guy really has something he's got. You know, and Kerry, he is pretty photogenic. I mean, I've seen a lot of pictures of the guy that kind of, you know, he has that kind of Kennedy esque kind of thing.
I think Lincoln-esque.
Lincoln. Well, he's kind of a weird
and tall.
He's
long.
Kind of a
long.
Yeah, it's true the camera can be unkind to him. He sometimes looks like sort of Ed Muskie. You know, has that kind of saggy look. But
have you heard people saying, John Kerry, why the long face? Because if you haven't, you will.
Ouch.
You'll hear it many times.
But I don't think he is going to be elected or not based on charisma. You know, there was this guy who wrote this book. I can't remember the name of the book, but it was about how people have too much choice. And he said there are two kinds of shoppers. One is the good enough shopper, and one is the person who always looks for the perfect thing. You know, I want the speakers that are, you know, have all these high specifications. It has to be exactly the right thing. Mm. And, you know, I think the Democrats this time around are, you know, we're the good enough shoppers. Mm. You know, it's like John Kerry has all the things we think are going to be necessary to beat George Bush. We think he's electable. That's good enough.
And then let's add to that and say the way to have enough Elvis along with the good enough is to nominate Bill Clinton as vice presidential running mate.
Ah, I was wondering how long it would take for that to come out.
I thought that was an original thought on my part, but it turns out there's now a New York Times op-ed, yes. And it's in the wind. And I have to say, it's an outrage in some ways to say that, but I'm all for it.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Tell
I'm
me
all
more.
For it.
Why?
Well, I mean, for one thing, just plain and simple, the man wins elections. Clinton's win elections. And there's that. There's
I'm hearing a negativity, though. You're wrestling with something. Why do you think you shouldn't be in favor of Bill Clinton being vice president?
Well, because what I actually know about political strategy is nothing. And the idea that there are people who are undecided is always completely mysterious. I don't understand who these people are, where they live, that they are influenced by a barrage of ads that say this man has been a good leader. I can't get inside that person.
So you think it's risk? So you think it's extra risky to go unconventional route of picking the former president, so it could be a turn off as well as a turn on?
Or a turn on, and maybe a risk is what we have to take in these moments, and the amount of attention around it. And I think in terms of our position in the world stage, Bill Clinton could really be the right running mate. So I throw it out there along with the gentleman who wrote the New York Times op-ed piece today.
Mm. Knut, how do you feel about
Kerry's running
Bubba.
Mate?
Yeah.
About Bubba?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I like Bubba, but I don't like him as a running mate. He could be very effective off the ticket, you know, fundraising and rallying the faithful and, you know, getting Hillary ready in case things don't work out another 4 years.
Rally the faithful when it's not about him? He's just saying, I like
Oh,
this
I think
other
he
guy.
Does. I saw him when he came to Seattle. Last fall, he was fantastic. He was even better than when he was president, you know, because he was relaxed. You know, he wasn't carrying all that baggage. He's a better speaker than ever. He's more motivating. And of course, he was sort of saying to the Democrats in the audience, he was basically saying, you know, stop fighting. You know, I can't do a Clinton, but, you know, it was basically, you know, stop being picky. Any one of these guys would be a great president. You know, let's just, you know, just get behind one. Mm.
Well, what about the backlash that Sandy wonders, the turnoff that Sandy wonders about? Is there a chance that the electorate or the swing voters would you say that's the best you can come up with, or in some way be?
Well, I think they would if he were actually on the ticket. That's why I think, you know, somebody like Clinton's more effective working whatever demographic groups are most effective. You don't want somebody on the ticket, a presidential candidate. You don't want somebody on the ticket who outshines you, you know, thus Quayle, Cheney, you know. And when you take a risk. You know, look at Mondale and Ferraro, you know, the idea that, well, I'm a liberal who loves to raise taxes, so I might as well take a risk, you know, and put a woman on the ticket. You know, that's just not good strategy.
See, I told you I was no political strategist.
Maybe
he could just drop hints that he's going to name him Secretary of State. Because I think that would also be satisfying. So maybe that.
Okay. Well, let's talk about these. Bush released his first TV campaign ads this week, three separate ads, and then one of them reproduced in Spanish. Notably, the ads include images of the destroyed World Trade Center and firefighters carrying a flag-draped stretcher through the rubble. Critics, including some family members of September 11th victims, called the ads a shameful exploitation of that disaster and called on Bush to retract the ads. On NPR's All Things Considered, Republican strategist and pollster Matthew Dowd defended the ads.
Obviously, we, along with the rest of the country, grieve with the families and the victims of 9/11. However, we think that 9/11 is an event that affected all America. It's a shared experience. And so as this one of the challenges that obviously occurred and a tragedy that occurred in the last 3 years, we thought it important that the debate be centered around that as well as other events and the policies in order to prevent another tragedy like that from happening is important.
The next hour, I'm going to open the phones and ask listeners how they feel about that ad footage. So, listeners, you can see those ads at, for example, the place that originated them, georgewbush.com/TV ads. Be aware, though, your computer may have a George Bush firewall, in which case that's what Google is for. Bush what about the ads? Have you seen the ads, first of all, Sandy?
Yes, I have.
And you work in the visual medium, filmmaker Sandy Siafi.
Well, I mean, they're, of course, well done. nothing that they're going to put out isn't going to be well done. What I like about the ads is that I think it's actually an accurate representation of the presidency in terms of its consistent, relentless exploitation of 9/11 for anything and everything that they choose to do as a matter of policy, and matters that are not of policy for that matter. So I actually think, to that extent, I'm glad they aired them. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that that has created the opportunity for the backlash that I think will continue to grow. And I think the mistake that the RNC has made in having the convention in New York City will come out. So I actually like that about the ads.
I think this backlash question is going to be really interesting from now through the election. Like, is Bush's use of September 11th going to be prompting outcries from people whose family members were, and this is not what they were hoping for. But Knut, did you see the ads the same way as being exploiting?
Well, I didn't think so. I didn't think they were any more exploitive of 9/11 than campaign ads are exploitive of the American flag or the amber waves of grain or the smiling families or whatever. I actually thought the ad that I saw used it very discreetly. It's only on camera for about 1 second. I agree with Sandy in the sense that if – you know, 9/11 is something that ought to be talked about during the campaign. It goes to the sort of heart of his presidency and the heart of the way he has decided to rule America with an iron fist. And I think it should be discussed, and I think it should be out there. And I'm fascinated by the fact that the sort of even very discreet mention of 9/11 in these ads has created somewhat of a firestorm of controversy, and I'm sure that's not what they wanted. It's probably going to prevent them from exploiting it in more egregious kinds of ways. But I didn't think the ads per se were tasteless or inappropriate or anything like that. I did think it was funny because I actually saw it on TV last night while I was watching Dateline. Katie Couric was interviewing Jason Blair, who was the New York Times reporter fired for lying. And then they had this Bush ad on during the Jason Blair thing. And I thought, boy, a couple of liars.
I happen to see the same thing. That's so interesting. But I just want to respectfully disagree for a moment and say I think there's an important distinction between exploiting iconographic images like amber waves of grain and this particular moment. And I think what has happened that a lot of the Bush people have not been paying attention to is that there's actually been a groundswell of people centered in New York, and some of whom are family members and people who are just New Yorkers who in general have not appreciated the exploitation of this moment in history for every kind of policy. I think that's really been a groundswell that they haven't paid attention to.
Well, I think you bring up a great point because everybody's experience of 9/11 is not equal. Mm-hmm. I was in Seattle safely in my living room. I never felt a personal threat. I didn't lose anybody at the Pentagon or at the World Trade Center. And I haven't lived like New Yorkers have lived with it, And I think people who live in New York and Washington, D.C. in particular have a very different experience of it. And they're going to have stronger reactions.
And I think a lot of people think, what you should have had to be proud of was the kind of speech that we had hoped a president would give at a time like that. And then perhaps you would use clips from that speech to inspire whether there would have
really?
Been.
See, some people were saying, well, at least he didn't use himself with a bullhorn on the rubble, making him the hero that this was tastefully done.
But I mean real leadership. I mean the kind of leadership that would have stepped on the world
stage.
Well,
now we're off whether the ads are exploitive or not. Right. But what about John Kerry, so-called, is it exploitive for him to show footage of death in Vietnam in his campaign ads?
Well, it depends on contextualize it. If he shows, if there are clips of him specifically as a Vietnam War veteran, that speaks to his record as a Vietnam War veteran. But if he's just using images of dead bodies in Vietnam, I think that's problematic.
Mm. Knut?
Well, part of his whole political career is based not only on heroic service in Vietnam, but opposition to the war when he got home. So he has kind of a broad way with which he can play with those images.
Right.
I don't think in general those things are exploitive.
This is Rewind on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke with Seattle Weekly editor Knut Berger and filmmaker Sandy Siafi. Still ahead, could Mars have supported life? And is it any of our business what home run hitters eat for breakfast? And more as we review the week's news. We're going to take a short break. Be right back in about a minute.
W comes from Seattle Theater Group, presenting Israel's internationally acclaimed Batsheva Dance Company, performing artistic director Ohad Naharin's Decca Dance. The evening includes a discussion with Mr. Naharin following the performance. Tickets for the Batsheva Dance Company are on sale now from Ticketmaster or online at theparamount.com.
The Swing Years and Beyond is a program featuring big bands, small combos, vocals, and instrumentals from the late 1920s through the 1950s. I'm Amanda Wild, inviting you to join me this Saturday night for swing, jazz, popular song, and more on The Swing Years and Beyond, live on 94.9 KUOW, NPR News and Information.
And make sure to join us at 3 o'clock this afternoon, a new time for a Prairie Home Companion here on KUOW. You can also hear a Prairie Home Companion Sunday mornings at 10. Currently 50 degrees, partly cloudy outside our studios. This is KUOW 94.9.
This is Rewind on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke. We're taking a leisurely look back at some of the top stories this week and some of the interesting features aired on NPR in the last 7 days. We'll talk about the prospects for Lefty Talk Radio in a few minutes, coming up on Fair and Balanced KUOW. Knut Berger edits Seattle Weekly, and Sandy Siafi is a Seattle filmmaker, and let's talk Martha Stewart, who was found guilty yesterday by a jury. She and her stockbroker were found guilty of lying to investigators about a stock sale. Stewart was convicted on all four charges she faced: conspiracy, obstruction of justice, and two counts of making false statements. Stewart could face as much as 5 years in prison for each of the charges, so that would be 20 years, although most analysts think that's very unlikely. The PRI, Public Radio International business show Marketplace, had an interesting interview with a woman named Karen Bond. She's a former white-collar prisoner. The story never said what she did. I guess maybe her agreement with the show. Oh, come on, just call me a former white-collar prisoner. She's now with the Federal Prison Policy Project, and Bond said if Stewart does time, it will be no trip to the country club, no club fed, no tennis courts, no golf courses.
You have approximately 300 women in this three-story building that has no air conditioning, has steam heat, still has the bars on the windows from back when it was a drug camp. I saw a lot of the press coverage, and they're speculating about the glamorous jobs and her decorating the prison. In reality, that won't happen. She will be randomly assigned to some menial task within the prison system. It could be working in the kitchen. It could be washing dishes. It could be as an orderly, cleaning the bathrooms. She could be put on the lawn crew. Everybody works in the federal prison system unless they are medically disabled.
Now, from what I know of Jay Leno, I don't expect any jokes about Martha Stewart cleaning prison bathrooms or being on lawn duty. But I can't say that with 100% accuracy. We can't know this for certain.
Everybody works in the federal prison.
That's right. Did you believe that?
Well, you know, just hearing this woman's litany of what you do, that's what Martha Stewart does for a living. I'm sorry. She lives in Connecticut. That is a white-collar prison. You know, she's somebody. The people who try to live like Martha Stewart, you know, are slaves. You know, they are slaves to, you know, maintaining the perfect house and growing the perfect plants and hand painting their little watering buckets and, you know, making, I don't know.
Doily handcuffs.
I was going to say, it's not even as useful as MacGyver, you know, could, you know.
So she's being sentenced to being her?
Exactly. It's like, I think she's well equipped, let us say, to move into the prison environment. Except, I mean, she's used to being in charge, but you know, it sounds like these people are living the kind of, you know, rigid existence that she promulgates.
Sandy Siafi, are you experiencing the same Blondenfreude that Knut Berger is expressing?
Well, you know, this story's a rough one for me because I found myself feeling more like Blondenfreude. I can't, for some reason, I'm not one of the people who feels impassioned about it because I'm suspicious that it's not really a signal that we're going to go after big white-collar criminals, though I hope it is. And if it is, I say, Ken Lay.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real, you know. So there's that. And then maybe it's just that somehow she's a tough character to get really impassioned about getting behind it one way or another. I don't know. I guess I was always scared of that way of life. You know, I've run very quickly and worked really hard to go nowhere near
to get away
anything
from the
like
chintz and
that life. Yeah.
Well, do you feel that she got a bad rap for being powerful and obnoxious?
Oh yeah.
she's
also guilty.
I hear outrage.
She's also
at
guilty.
That,
I mean, she's guilty of what she was found guilty of. I mean, she certainly lied. That seems pretty clear.
By the way, that's filmmaker and federal securities legal analyst, Andy Cioffi.
She could say that now.
And juror.
It's in the books.
Yeah,
the conviction's in the books.
Okay.
She is guilty. You know, whether we think she's... The thing is, the argument about, you know, people... I was really interested in The Office yesterday. I mean, it was like the whole office came to a halt while we watched, you know, the thing, and people were discussing it. It doesn't cut along ideological grounds. You know, it's like... There are people, liberals, who are passionately think that, you know, the federal government shouldn't be railroading people like Martha Stewart when Ken Lay is, you know, in his ski chalet. Mm. You know, and then there are other people who are like, yeah, you know, she's like Leona Helmsley. They just, you know, they want to see her. So it kind of cuts across. My take on it is, I mean, it seemed pretty, just from following the trial, it seemed like she was guilty. She's convicted. You know, she ought to be punished. I have no idea what a fair punishment would be. I can't imagine it would be 20 years in prison. I mean, that's what they put people – that's for something serious like marijuana.
Right, that's right.
I mean, you know, maybe a year, whatever. But, you know, if you're looking for proportionality – I mean, she was convicted of all the things that Richard Nixon should have been convicted of. And, you know, he didn't do a day. You know, he got pardoned. That's always her hope.
See, I think one of my favorite things about this story is that it raises really uncomfortable questions about crime and punishment that most middle-class white people don't talk about or look at or feel uncomfortable about as often as they should. I think I've heard people say things after yesterday's verdict like, well, I don't really think she should actually go to jail. I mean, jail, that's a horrible place. That's where bad criminals belong. And there are all these assumptions that people make about, well, the people who are subjected to the horror of having your free will taken away must be horrible. And they don't look at what it's really like and what kind of really small drug crimes a whole lot of people are serving hard time for.
Well, exactly. This is what all the Limbaugh fans have been saying, too. Exactly. You know, when Rush Limbaugh, you know, having been accused, you know, and having, well, admitted to having a drug problem and possibly obtaining these drugs illegally. And, you know, the liberals are all like, throw them in the slammer, throw away the key, you know, and all the conservatives are like, no, you know, they were prescription medications. It just got out of control. You know, a little rehab is all he needs.
Well, here's your last chance before she goes in the hole to say, I'm hearing a desire for this story to pass into its proper place in the perspective of history. So are there any final words you'd like to say to Martha as she floats down the river?
Well, I think she should know that at a time that a lot of gay men are trying to get married, that many of them will be going to her Martha Stewart wedding book, even if it's pulled off the shelves.
Okay.
I think that'll happen.
She can take that away. And Knut, anything you'd like to...
Not really. I think, except that, you know, when you're going to try and save yourself a few bucks, you know, sometimes it's good to think twice. You know, I mean, this whole thing was like, yeah, if she just told the truth, she would have been out, you know, 50 grand instead of about $500 million
right.
dollars that she's lost. So
and years of her life, perhaps.
Speaking of proportionality.
And by that, we mean days of her life.
So
this is Rewind on KUOW 94.9. I'm Bill Radke with Knut Berger, editor of Seattle Weekly, and filmmaker Sandy Cioffi, reviewing some of the news stories of the week. And since Rush Limbaugh came up, we will be talking about the prospect of liberal ditto heads. Is there something about liberals that just doesn't say talk radio? We're going to meet a liberal talk show host out of Fargo who has a following and says it absolutely can work. But first, do you care whether home run hitters are artificially pumped up? Major League Baseball's spring training is being marred, I say, by allegations of steroid and performance-enhancing drug use. San Francisco, the aptly named San Francisco Giant, Barry Bonds, hit a record 73 home runs in 2001. The San Francisco Chronicle has now published information given to federal investigators alleging that Bonds received illegal steroids and human growth hormone from his personal trainer. The Chronicle also named New York Yankees stars Jason Giambi and Gary Sheffield, three other major leaguers, and an NFL player as having gotten steroids. NPR reporter Tom Goldman told us a reporter tried to ask Bonds about the issue at his locker when a Giants PR executive blocked him.
Dude, don't even try. I told you earlier. Talk to his attorney.
As the reporter retreated, Bonds continued dressing, at one point stripping off his shirt and revealing his chiseled upper body that makes skeptics wonder, how does a 39-year-old man look like that?
Bonds denies using these substances, which, as Pete Rose taught us, should put the debate to rest. Filmmaker Sandy Siafi, do you give a... Well, Les Carpenter writes for the Seattle Times, and he wrote a column this week about the scandal, and he asked, do fans really care what athletes put into their bodies? I don't even know whether you're a baseball fan, Sandy, but...
I'm a New Yorker.
You're from Brooklyn, so you've got to be a baseball fan.
And, of course, since I'm from Brooklyn, I'm a Mets fan. I was raised by an ex-Brooklyn Dodger fan, mm-hmm. which means Mets. Mm. You know, this is a tough story. One thing about it is that I remember liking baseball more than other male professional sports because the guys looked more normal, because they seemed more like somebody you'd meet down the street. And something about them was less sort of jarhead frightening. And I miss that. I miss that they're not a little more normal looking. And, you know, I do think that it is a compelling question whether or not all the asterisks in the history books will have to, you know, put this, you know, all the records to question. But I think that...
In case some listeners don't know, you put an asterisk next to a record that's... Is that well known that if it was wind-aided, if it was in a different era where the ball was different, so it's not... It takes away from the record. There's an asterisk next to your name. So, you know, steroid-enhanced. Yeah, perhaps.
Steroid-enhanced home run record.
Yes.
But your question, to go to your question of fans, I just say the difficulty with that question is people will pay tickets for some pretty frightening things. So whether or not fans will pay tickets to go and see this can't necessarily be the arbiter by which decisions are made.
Sure. Yeah, people would buy tickets to public executions. I mean, you know, I think that's a really wise point. I think the fans have assumed that a lot of these guys are taking steroids. I mean, you're sitting in that crowd and you see guys like Mark McGwire or Barry Bonds who suddenly develop huge muscles and an ability to hit the ball with great power late in their careers.
Yes.
And I think it just raises questions about, you know, wow, what are they doing? You know, and I, you know, if you're kind of live in fantasy land, you can think, well, it's some kind of great workout regimen.
And Atkins, they're all on the Atkins side.
Yes, right. It's all
Atkins aided.
Yeah.
They're going to need an asterisk.
I mean, you know, baseball, I don't think, you know, you can't go back and put asterisks everywhere at this point just because, I mean, you know, players have been playing with substances in their systems for a long time. I mean, not just steroids, but, you know, they're guys that pitched on coke and you know, famous baseball players who were drunk half the time. I think if you want to level the playing field, you could ban all substances. But if you banned working out, you know, just in the off season, say you can't work out. You come into spring training, you know, which is what they used to do in the old days.
Yeah.
You know, the old days, these guys, you know, they had jobs.
I would become a professional left fielder if that happened.
Exactly. There would be more people who could play, and you wouldn't have this sort of, you know, super stud phenomenon, you know, where the catcher has to be 6 feet tall and weigh, you know, 280 or something. I mean, it is kind of amazing.
And, you know, if you alcohol adjusted and steroid adjusted the record and you had Babe Ruth versus... You know, versus any of the guys who have beaten his record, you'd have to say he'd be three times their record. Because wouldn't you say that if he was boozed up a lot, apparently?
Yes.
Doesn't that make you less of a home run hitter?
That's right. Ruth hit 60 home runs, which is 60 drunk home runs, which is like 120 sober home runs.
That's what I think.
This is Rewind on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio, where legally, because we're licensed by the University of Washington, I have to give you both urine tests right now. So please, while I'm introducing this next piece, if you would there's the cup right there. Thank you. let's talk about, well, still ahead on the program, we're going to ask about whether Mars could have supported life and what the implications of that, the discovery of indications of water on the Red Planet are. But first, Multnomah County this week was the latest big American municipality, this is the home of Portland, Oregon, to give same-sex couples marriage licenses. Some couples were married on the spot by a rabbi who stood in front of the county administration building. Others waited for a mass wedding that afternoon. A newly formed Oregon group called the Defense of Marriage Coalition filed a court injunction against the county to stop the weddings. In Chicago, demonstrators sat down in the street this week and demanded that Cook County issue same-sex marriage licenses. And my plan today on Rewind, I was going to ask, where are the Seattle protests? Well, this morning, Seattle Times reports that local gay and lesbian couples and their supporters will march on the King County Administration Building on Monday morning and demand marriage licenses. A spokesperson for County Executive Ron Sims said, they can come every day, but we won't be able to issue them marriage licenses. It is against the law. The state passed the Defense of Marriage Act in 1998, 2 years after President Clinton signed a similar measure for the nation, defining marriage as a union between a man and a woman. So I ask you, should Ron Sims, King County executive, an elected official, sworn to uphold the law and running for governor, flout state law and issue these licenses? He says he's sympathetically with the demonstrators. Knute Bircher, do you have an opinion?
I don't think he should violate the law unless his conscience dictated that he do that. I think the most effective thing he could do would become, a vocal advocate for gay marriage and swear that he was going to change state law if he becomes governor. He's running for office. I don't think you can insist that a quote lawmaker or elected representative be civilly disobedient. But civil disobedience is how this thing is going to change. What is going on in San Francisco and New York and New Mexico and Oregon and these other places where they're either finding loopholes in the law or in some cases openly defying the law. You know, that's going to create the court cases that's going to get, eventually result in gay marriage being legalized. I mean, my opinion about it is gay marriage is already in the Constitution in the sense that, everybody is to be treated equally. And, this is one of the things, I think gay marriage is already constitutional. I don't think it should be prohibited in the Constitution, but it's going to have to work its way through the legal system to gain the kind of acceptance.
Sandy Shafi, any opinion about whether King County Executive Ron Sims ought to jumpstart that process with
I think he ought to, as a matter of personal conscience, just because I've been listening to his speeches for many years, and it would be inconsistent of him not to. It would be inconsistent of him, though I would understand the political expedience in not defying the law, and I don't think you can necessarily demand that he defy the law, but I think I would highly suggest that he do it and live up to the speeches he's given about what you do as a member of the world community in terms of civil rights. So, yes, I think on a lighter note, I think he's probably afraid that he'll go the way of the mayor of, I think it's Nyack, New York, who was the first, I think, official who actually outright defied the law. And a phrase has been bandied about the media, I think intentionally, quite a bit, which is that he was accused of solemnizing, which is quite obviously used by the press over and over again for its likeness to the word sodomizing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he'd be afraid the headline in the Seattle Times would be Sims solemnizes, which he quite likely would be. But I do think he should do it.
It is the county executive, the county and not the city that originates these licenses. After a short break, I want to ask another question or two about the gay marriage story. For example, why did Seattle supporters of same-sex marriage need so much prompting to protest? Is it A, we're polite, B, Sims is a Democrat, so we can get away with it, C, we can just drive 3 hours to Portland, which is a nice place to visit anyway. They have a nice rose garden and a zoo and a river and no sales tax, and they pump your gas for you. Or D, the local gay community understands that the anti-gay backlash threatens to roll back all of their recent gains, as some say. So we'll pick that up and cover a couple of more stories of the week right after a short break on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio.
1240, 50 degrees, some clouds outside our studios in Seattle's University District. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Kathy Ducharme in for Derek Wong.
This week on American Roots, it's the blues. We have two heavyweights of the music. First, a portrait of larger-than-life Muddy Waters.
I brought it to Chicago and put the big beat behind it. It's the same Delta Blues in my book, though, you know.
After Muddy, the very much alive Chicago blues man, Buddy Guy. I'm Nick Spitzer. Tune in for American Roots from PRI.
Join us for American Roots today at 6 p.m., also tomorrow, Sunday at 6, here on KUOW.
This is Rewind on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Bill Radke with Seattle filmmaker Sandy Siafi and Seattle Weekly editor Knute Berger. Water on Mars and liberal ditto heads still to come on Rewind. But I just wanted to ask whether you had, my guests, any opinion about the state of good old protest. I saw the pictures in Cook County of people sitting down on the streets, and in Seattle, where Ron Simms was saying, my hands are tied. State law says I can't issue same-sex marriage licenses. Now they're saying that some people are going to march on the administration building on Monday. But did it seem to take a while? Where our neighbors, you know, it was happening all around us, and seemed like historical dominoes falling and. And Seattle seemed very patient on the issue to me.
Well, I think, you know, the history books will show that we're going to have to give a lot of credit to Gavin Newsom for really jump-starting what will be, I think Knute's right, a series of civil disobediences around the country that will be a really important part of this debate. But his having known his constituents in San Francisco and being the first place to say, come and line up, that wasn't necessarily a protest as much as it was a celebration. And I think that kick-started where we are. So I think that it's unfortunate that we haven't kick-started as a celebration, but instead that it'll have to be a protest.
Yeah. Well, criticizing us for not being first is like criticizing somebody for not leaping up, first everybody. You can't be first in the wave. You know, you're doing the wave around the stadium. Somebody starts it, and then you jump in and join in. And, Seattle is not that uniquely innovative a place that, you know, we're on the cutting edge of every social issue.
Well, one of the board members.
Whether they do it a week late or 2 weeks late, the rest of the country is so far behind on this thing that, you know, we're still on the cutting edge if people are worried about our image.
Well, more than one, Jamie Peterson, co-chair of the board of directors for Lambda Legal, a national gay rights advocacy group, was quoted in the PI saying, if a challenge is brought in the wrong way, it could set the gay marriage movement in Washington back a long way.
Well, I want to say two things. One is it wasn't necessarily criticism. It was an acknowledgement that for San Francisco is where they should be. And I think we will be where we should be. I actually think the backlash argument is an important one to dispel. What's really at stake here is, again, the sense of feeling normal. And a lot of people are sort of re-experiencing a sense of trauma around coming out again. People who have been out for 20 years are going back through the sense of not being normal and I don't get a Cuisinart too. And I don't mean that in a greedy sense, more like you get the Cuisinart because grandma thinks you're normal.
Mm-hmm.
It's really, for anyone who's ever seen in a gay pride parade, when PFLAG comes, which is the parents and friends of lesbians and gays, every gay person anywhere in the area is brought to their knees crying because it's the group that says you're okay, your parents still support you. You can find a 70-year-old gay man who will come to his knees crying when that happens. And that's really what's at issue here. So we absolutely have to chip away at a civil rights issue like this. Regardless, backlash is a part of that. I mean, hosing Black people down in the South on national television was a part of the reason that you do the nonviolent civil disobedience so that what's hateful about the other side becomes obvious.
Seattle Weekly editor Knute Berger, any final thoughts on what the Chicago Tribune called our big fat gay month? I mean, it's been a thrilling, I'm trying to think of a neutral word, whether you were in favor of it or not, it's, boy, you sort of feel alive in history the last month.
you know, gay marriage is going to happen. It's going to be inevitable. You know, it may not happen all at once, but people are, I think, putting pressure on is a good thing. I don't think you can really worry about the backlash part. And once every gay couple that wants to get married can get married, you know, then they're going to discover the pleasures of gay divorce.
Mm.
You know, they're going to find out that marriage as an institution is highly problematic.
This is Rewind on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio. I'm Bill Radke with filmmaker Sandy Siafi and Seattle Weekly editor Knute Berger, reviewing some of the interesting stories from the week's news, including from NASA. The Mars rover Opportunity has provided the best evidence yet that water once flowed on Mars. On NPR's Morning Edition, Cornell University geologist Steve Squires told us there are, first of all, tiny little spheres, nicknamed blueberries, embedded in the Martian bedrock that are built of material dissolved by water. Then there are the small pockets in the rock outcrop that appear to be molds that once held mineral crystals inside that were dissolved away by water. And then there's the presence of sulfur and our old friend, the sulfur-bearing mineral, jarosite.
So, combination of probable concretions, these things that we think are crystal molds, the sulfur, the sulfates, and particularly the jarosite, you put that story together, and it's hard to avoid the conclusion that this stuff was deposited in liquid water. This was a groundwater environment. This is the kind of place that would have been suitable for life. Now, that doesn't mean life was there. We don't know that. But this was a habitable place on Mars at one point in time.
I love that guy. All grown-ups should be that thrilled at some point in their work day.
I know, and this is a guy who makes his living looking at dirt. It's like, you know, rocks. Geologists are amazing. It's so complicated. There's all this stuff they can tell. You know, it's sort of like watching CSI or Quincy or something. You know, it's like they look at all these little things and they deduct all these things. And, you know, if I were on Mars, I'd be going, yeah, it's a lot of red dirt.
Yeah. Sandy, did you have a reaction to a watery planet?
Well, like Knute, I love the entire category of people who can be so excited about perseverating on the smallest detail, whether it's DNA or rock.
Did you say perseverating?
I did.
Good word.
That's because he said concretion, uh-huh. And I got so excited.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, go on.
I just wanted to mark that.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm with you. Perseverating.
She's ratcheting up her bloviation.
Yeah.
I got so excited. I read all these articles about it, and I never would have. And the whole thing that I was loving was the whole debate about ice versus liquid water. And there's ice now, but they think there might be actual liquid water somewhere in the water table underneath.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty fascinating.
And the human race has been speculating about this for a long time. Again, it seems when it's on the news, it seems kind of normal. But then sometimes if you really early in the morning when you've just awakened and haven't gotten used to the news cycle, you just go, water on Mars? didn't I read short stories about this as a child?
And the phrase wet Mars kept coming out. I thought that was a good one.
Well, you know, what's so funny, too, is the whole myth that, you know, especially if you grew up watching cartoons, you know, was Mars had canals on it. So it was always like this Venice planet, you know, where the little Martians would have the gondolas, you know, mm-hmm. and be going down the canals. And it's sort of interesting to think that we're finding out that, in fact, there was water on this planet, but there was no way we could have known that, except we kind of did intuitively. You know, so it sort of makes you wonder, was there water on Mars when people were around? Did they somehow know?
I love that you said that about the canals, because I remember I just loved that show, My Favorite Martian. And whenever I would watch that show, I would always think about the canals and have these imagination festivals. When I'd go to sleep, I'd see the canals and people floating. I love that you said that. It's so true.
Well, the finding marked the first direct evidence that the Martian surface was once warmer and awash in liquid water. But scientists say that they think this ended billions of years ago. So the chance of someone still kind of hanging around
Well,
who's a bearded guy who can tell us the good stories of the old days are looking remote.
Yeah, no, but maybe it was some oral mythology passed down by a caveman or something. Mm-hmm. But you have the feeling they're going to find on Mars, you know, some chiseled inscription that says there is no global warming.
See, that's fabulous, because I was going to say, in the I'm suspicious of everything department, I started getting suspicious of this story because it started to sound like, well, when we're trashed here, we've got somewhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
The old sort of outpost after Armageddon kind of idea.
Right.
But maybe it's the other way around. Maybe we're the old outpost after the last Armageddon.
Yeah, that's we came from Mars.
Uh-huh.
We screwed up Mars and we came here.
Very Ray Bradbury.
Wow.
Well, this is, I noticed in this NPR story that the host tossed off the phrase, water is necessary for life. I thought, whoa. How do we know that? Isn't that kind of arrogant for us to say? What? First of all, we were arrogant to say that there couldn't be life elsewhere in the universe, right? But now we're very confidently saying that water is necessary for life.
Right. We're finding out all kinds of things about life. You know, they're finding like bacteria that you know, living in Antarctica. They're finding bacteria living in these, you know, volcanic things under the water.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding life in all these places. And it turns out, you know, it's life that doesn't even breathe oxygen and everything. So,
what, did Bush pass a constitutional amendment declaring that life can only be between a hydrogen and an oxygen?
No, but don't give them any ideas.
You know, maybe we should be expanding our definition of life.
I think you're probably right that what life is going to be absolutely changed. I mean, didn't it already change last year that wasn't there some big debate about whether or not it's that there's carbon, whether or not something's organic, that there are now beings that don't have respiration?
That don't have carbon, yeah,
and
right.
And they have no carbon, yes. Or some craziness in some stalactite.
Right.
Some ite.
Yeah, well, that sounds familiar. It's, you know, but you wonder what the creationists are going to do.
Yes, that's my question.
When they find life up there.
Well, the Bible doesn't say God only made one heaven and one earth, right? Maybe that's why he got ours done in 7 days, because he'd streamline the process. He had this efficiency, you know, economy of scale.
Need other planets to get to.
There you go.
That's what he was doing on Sunday.
That's what he was doing on Sunday.
Wasn't resting after all.
He was moonlighting. Of course he kept it on the DL. Okay, we're going to Hell on Rewind on KUOW 94.9 Public Radio, and we have time before we descend for one more topic.
Speaking of hell.
In the week's news, if you've ever visited AM Talk Radio, you know it's populated with basically Ichiro, Frank Sinatra, God, and right-wingers. There's not much liberal talk radio. But this week, NPR's All Things Considered introduced us to Ed Schultz, who broadcasts out of Fargo, North Dakota, and is touted as the left's answer to Rush Limbaugh. Skeptics say liberal talk radio could never catch on like the conservative kind, but Schultz says not true. He told reporter John Itzty that Rush types dominate only because they've been successful in the past and network owners have been copying a winning formula.
The industry is conservative talk radio. Mm-hmm. There isn't anything else. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else.
So
there hasn't been liberal talk radio because ownership hasn't had to try it.
Mm-hmm. They've been so successful with the conservative product that they haven't felt they needed the liberal
product. John, it is that simple. It really is.
But is anything really that simple? See, that's the knock on liberals, is they don't see things as simple. They're relativists, and they don't have the black and white view of the world that attracts the average radio listener. What think you, Knute Berger?
I was just thinking, you know, North Dakota's really a great... That's why North Dakota's so famous as a test market for everything.
That's right.
You know? It's like,
as
those,
North Dakota
I mean,
goes.
I would imagine it's so bleak up there that people would listen to anything. You know, any live voice coming from anywhere.
If there are any other stereotypes in your head that you want to just utter, that you want to express,
unload
absolutely.
The stereotype closet.
Sure,
yeah.
Sure, let it go.
It's pretty ugly in there.
Okay.
But... you know, liberal talk radio, I mean, I thought we were on it, aren't we?
You're talking about fair and balanced?
Fair and balanced
public
NPR.
Radio? Yeah.
Fair and balanced NPR.
Well, that's certainly the accusation, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I wish we could call it populist radio instead of liberal. Because I just want to say I kind of agree, you know, the medium is the message. Like, it's hard to know if it's conservative or liberal or if it's just jerks do well. In that format.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not really a debate. It's just a way of lambasting and screaming and making fun of people. So if lefty politics doesn't do well in that arena, maybe that should be something to be proud of.
I wonder. I don't mind that. I listen to Rush Limbaugh sometimes, and I don't mind that he's conservative. I mind that he twists the truth around, and I don't feel like I've learned anything. And I worry about a liberal version of that.
There are some liberal radio people in town, often at weird hours.
On Cairo.
Yeah, Cairo has Mike Webb, who I've been on his show, but I also think it's great. But the interesting thing about it, I've noticed, is that the people who call in on Mike Webb are mostly conservative. And, you know, they call in to yell at the liberal guests. Not all of them, but, you know, a
that sounds like good radio.
You know, so it's sort of...
I wish that would happen here.
Yeah. Well, so, I don't know whether... I guess the rap against liberal talk is that, you know, liberals equivocate too much and have too much self-doubt. And Rush Limbaugh says, you know, liberals hate themselves and...
Is that true?
You know, maybe self-loathing. No, I don't think it is true, but I can see why it might look that way.
I heard Gore Vidal speak recently, and he said that he had spent the night before in a meeting with this man who's starting the new, there's a new FM liberal station, and he was discussing that, you know, Al Franken and Jimmy Garofalo and...
Robert F. Kennedy Jr.
And I think, is Molly Ivins and Jim Hightower, will they do that
will
as well?
Merge?
I don't know. Into
everyone's,
one person?
Everyone's merged into one. Well, you know, I mean, and I could tell you, Molly Ivins, Jim Hightower, and Michael Moore, you know, I mean, I could barely stand those people now, you know, yammering at me on the right. I wouldn't tune in, and I agree with them half the time, and
that's
I still wouldn't
question.
Tune in.
See, because you're a relativist, equivocator.
Self-loathing equivocator.
Well, and I was going to say, you know, if Gore Vidal is on, who I adore as a writer and did not always agree with, but his place in history is important, et cetera. But Gore Vidal is the contemporary equivalent of William Buckley, and I don't think William Buckley would do well on conservative talk radio. I mean, that's not a market. It's not the equivalent market.
Right.
It doesn't work. So way too many big words.
Way too many big words.
And that's coming from me.
Who said, used the
who
word
perseverating
not long
a few
ago.
A moments ago, yeah.
Al Franken, you're right, there's a liberal radio, a populist radio network called Progress Media that is supposed to hit the air this spring with comedian Al Franken and others. And Franklin says he would like a platform to attack his nemesis, Bill O'Reilly, from Fox. He says, we're trying to get sued by a right-wing jerk, hence the name of our program, The O. Franken Factor. So we'll see where that works out. Any final thoughts on the week before we bid you adieu?
I want to be on the liberal radio station.
You do?
Yeah. Okay. I want to give it a shot. I would love exactly what Knut said, to have a call-in show where all the conservatives call in and take a crack at you.
Mm.
I'd enjoy that.
Knut?
Well, having been in that position, I can tell you it's not fun. You find yourself refighting battles like fluoridation and, Formosa, you know, so it gets pretty scary.
Well, will you come back on Rewind sometime and review the week's news?
Regardless of your ideological bent, Bill, I would be here.
Actually, irregardless is a larger word and therefore preferable in that context.
Although a strange double negative.
Knut Berger edits Seattle Weekly, writes the Mossback column. Sandy Siafi is producing a documentary on the Immigrant Workers' Freedom Ride for PBS. And Kathy Ducham has been our engineer this hour. NPR News is next. And then Rewind continues with your phone calls. President Bush's use of scenes from September 11th in his campaign ads. Stay tuned.
This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, NPR News and Information. 12:59, your opinions next on Rewind. Stay with us.
Support for KUOW comes from the University of Washington, Bothell, accepting applications for master's degree programs for professionals in policy studies, nursing, education, and business. Details available at 425-352-5000 and online at uwb.edu.
In Seattle, partly cloudy, 50 degrees. Everett reporting partly cloudy skies and 46. Tacoma, partly cloudy, 49. The National Weather Service has revised its forecast for today. Partly sunny this afternoon, highs around 50. This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle. It's 1 o'clock.